Around Comics, episode
69. Comics, a roundtable discussing topics in and around the world of comics. I'm your host, Christopher Niesman, and I'm joined, as always, by my partner in crime and the co-host of the show, Brian Salazar.
Hello, everyone.
And next is our other co-host, our good buddy, Mr. Tom Caters.
It's Halloween in January.
Ooh. And our guest this week is comic veteran, Mr. Hilary Barta.
Yeah, they brought in the Crypt Keeper for Halloween.
Comic veteran, you mean?
On the
in country.
Yeah, that's me. I did that gag once in What the Guy was a Vietnam vet, and he actually was a veterinarian in Vietnam. But anyway.
Vietnam vet?
Yeah.
Nice. Well, all the boo-ha-ha stuff is because this is one of our Comics 101 episodes. Today we're going to be going over entertaining comics?
Education. Well, it was originally education.
We'll get to all that. It is EC Comics 101. But before we get to that, I want to let you know that this episode of Around Comics is sponsored by InStockTrades.com.
Make InStockTrades.com your source for all of the EC archives. InStockTrades will have each archive available and ready to ship the same day they are released. Don't let this chance to collect some of the most influential comics in history pass you by. At 30% off retail price, InStockTrades.com makes the EC archives an affordable addition to any collection. While you're picking up the latest EC archive, don't forget to check out InStockTrade's amazing selection of trade paperbacks, deluxe hardcovers, essentials, showcases, absolute editions, omnibus editions, and more, all at great discounted prices. All orders over $50 ship free, InStockTrades.com.
Thank you, InStockTrades.com. Would like to let everyone know that Around Comics is recorded every Friday at 7 o'clock at Dark Tower Comics and Collectibles, located at 4835 Northwestern Avenue in Chicago. If you're in the area, please drop by. We would love to meet you. We actually have several people that dropped by this evening. It's good to see everyone here.
Sorry.
Make some
waving.
Noise, people. All right.
They're waving.
When you're here, yes, they won't see you wave. When you're here, remember to ask about Dark Tower's Pull List membership. It is truly one of the best you will find anywhere. Dark Tower has a great selection of mainstream comics, independent comics, trade paperbacks, as well as statues and action figures. Come to Dark Tower for all of your comics and collectibles needs. All right, guys, this is, as we said a couple minutes ago, one of our Comics 101 segments. We did G.I. Joe a couple months back.
That was our first, yes.
And that was
and we've been planning on doing, yeah, our only.
That was, yeah, we've been planning to do this one since about Halloween, but the timing just wasn't right.
Yeah, because it made no sense to do it around Halloween. It makes so much more sense
to do it
in the second week of January. But
this is such a 2007 topic, is what we thought.
Well, those horror titles will send a chill up your
spine. Oh, ooh, way to tie it.
That's why we bring Hilary around.
Oh, man.
Yes, to send a chill up your spine.
So, Sal, you are the presenter for this episode. So tell us, edutain us about EC Comics.
EC Comics originally was called Educational Comics, and Max Gaines, the founder of EC Comics, is often credited with being the father of modern comic books. In 1933, Max had the bright idea of selling reprints of Sunday color comic strips. When he created Famous Funnies, the first four-color saddle-stitch newsprint pamphlet, he invented the standard comic book format we know today. While Famous Funnies was able to bring Max a few bucks, before long he started looking around for a new source of material. In 1938, Max received a draft of an original comic book strip. The strip, crudely drawn by two teenage boys named Jerry Schuster and Jerome Siegel, wasn't really up to the quality of the Sunday Funnies, but it had a kind of raw, compelling fascination, and at least it was original. So Max decided to print this comic called Superman. This was the creation of the first original material comic book, and Gaines prospered when Superman and other comic book creations went up, up, and away in sales. In 1945, Max sold most of his comics properties, including The Flash, Green Lantern, and the Justice Society of America, to DC Comics, retaining only two, Picture Stories from the Bible and Picture Stories from World History. Those enormous
movie franchises.
Yes,
also known as one of the best business decisions ever.
I can't wait to see the new Picture Stories from the Bible movie.
Of course, those were completely original, too. He wrote the Bible, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the Bible.
Max was old. It was in public domain at that point.
Let's not get into that. Anyway.
Not apocryphal. I'm sorry, I didn't say that. Let's continue.
In 1946, he used those titles as the foundation of a new publishing venture, Educational Comics, EC for short, and ran a line of illustrated Bible and American history stories. Unfortunately, tragedy struck in the summer of 1947. On August 20th, Max Gaines died in what is reported as a boating accident, although some sources state that Gaines sacrificed himself to save a small drowning boy. The company was inherited by his 25-year-old son, William M. Gaines. William Gaines had little interest in his father's business. "Comics, I hated them," he wrote in the 1954 piece. "Never touched the stuff. I wanted to be a chemistry teacher." Now he was stuck with a line of pious comics and a pre-CCA code of comic book conduct that was drawn up by his father's editor, Sheldon Mayer. At first, William only showed up at the office to issue paychecks. Eventually, though, he resigned himself to the fate of comic book publisher and decided to get to work. He secularized his titles, gradually retiring the Bible stories in favor of genres that were selling to young post-war consumers. In 1948, he hired 22-year-old Albert Feldstein. Feldstein was every boss's favorite employee, a hardworking idea man with inexhaustible energy and a nose for the market. Within a few years, the funny animals and the educational books were completely phased out as EC introduced magazines devoted to romance, space adventures, detective stories, and the Old West. The lineup included such titles as Saddle Justice, Crime Patrol, and Moon Girl. Then, perhaps noticing the advent of a few horror titles, Eerie was the first in 1947, they introduced horror elements into their Crime Patrol and War on Crime titles. On the cover of the penultimate issue of Crime Patrol, Gaines and Feldstein introduced a particular story as From the Crypt of Terror. They were surprised to find that this issue sold better than any issue before it. On the next cover, there was a conscious effort to promote the horror theme, and that book sold better than the previous issue. They had found what they were looking for.
I like the idea of, like, going into a crypt and finding, like, a story in there. This is from the Crypt of Horror.
It's too bad they couldn't have done the horror thing earlier. Then they could have had picture horror stories from the Bible. That would have been cool. Yeah.
Jesus was the first zombie.
Oh, you know, yeah. No kidding.
Raised from the dead.
Plenty of violence, destruction, and awful things happen in the Bible.
But from a serious point, if you look back at the beginning of EC and think how different the comics landscape would be now if they didn't sell the Flash and Green Lantern and Superman. I mean that was a huge moment in comics history.
Well, yeah, it's hard to say what may have happened. I mean, at some point, I don't think those properties would have disappeared. I mean, but they may not be nearly as well known, maybe as we know them today. I don't know.
If EC had happened sooner, you mean earlier?
Well, if he hadn't sold off those properties initially to DC, and DC went on to make them.
Well, the fact is that the superhero titles did drop in sales severely in the 50s, so mm-hmm. it might have happened that he would have been looking for something else anyway if he had kept DC.
Yeah, maybe.
At the time, and it's definitely as we go on through here, through the history of EC, it probably looked like the most sound decision that was made because it was really the horror comics and war comics that kind of,
and those Bible stories were hot sellers.
Hot
right?
Bible story action. Oh, worship that golden calf.
All right. What is next in EC history?
Well, in 1950, William cleaned house. He junked all the old titles and replaced them with a bold line he called New Trend Comics. War Against Crime became the Vault of Horror. Crime Patrol was made over into the Crypt of Terror. Gaines and Feldstein added weird science and weird fantasy to the line as an outlet for their shared enthusiasm for science fiction, and later minted shock suspense stories, crime suspense stories, and the Haunt of Fear. As each horror and suspense title was created, it displaced and discontinued another old title. The basic EC story formula relied on elemental moral tenets of good and evil. Although virtue didn't always come out on top, the truly bad characters in any given story got what was coming to them in one perverse way or another. Given the unspoken premise that any portrayed evil was being set up for a fall, part of the fun of an EC horror comic was the big payoff at the very end, the grotesque but ironic physical retribution that was a trademark of a EC-style story. However, the sheer volume of material required for Feldstein's titles, 4 to 5 stories per week, occasionally resulted in a formulaic approach. Filling 7 titles with stories meant coming up with one story every day, an obviously daunting challenge to the Feldstein Gaines team in the early days when they alone produced each tale. Luckily, Gaines was an insomniac who would read science fiction and horror books, far into the night, jotting down ideas that would be used as springboards for his daily meeting with Feldstein.
When they're talking about one story a day, I think that people think of that in the modern convention of writing a 22-page comic now, and I think at that what these were really 10 to 12 page stories.
Yeah, except they didn't have 10-page fight scenes. They were stories. They had a plot that had to begin, middle, and ending. It had to be resolved in those pages. So, you know, unlike a superhero comic where you can kind of just run along and then tell another story, you could go on for 4 issues. These were, you know, they had to be a story.
So no one's been waiting for the archives since the 50s, saying, I'm going to wait to get all of them in one shot.
Waiting for the trade.
Waiting for the trade
just
on
decompress.
This.
My favorite part of that sort of formulaic element that entered into the comics is there's if you read a lot of EC horror titles especially, there's this story that keeps coming around where this henpecked husband sort of eventually loses it and butchers, you know, grinds, throws her out a window, whatever, does something to the wife that's been driving him crazy,
over
or her family,
over.
Whatever. Yeah, but it just
that's one. It's actually one of the first stories in the suspense stories.
Story.
Yeah, it's flipped. It's the henpecked wife,
right?
And
rooster-pecked.
And the rooster-pecked, exactly. You know, the husband is such a, you know, he's such an anal freak about, you know, organization and whatnot, and she, like, you know, ends up like killing him, cutting him up and putting him in jars that are all, you know,
perhaps
organized.
That would be
the best way.
It's
the best way to store human beings in multiple jars, as always.
But yeah, there were a lot of those stories. There's some Freudian stuff going on in that office, I'm sure. You know? Little sublimated.
At least there's one where someone grinds up an editor. Why are there all these stories about
editors?
They
did actually feature in the stories a few times. They brought themselves in, yeah.
It was my job to sell him a springboard. As it got to 11 or 12 o'clock, I'd be getting desperate because I knew he had to finish a story, Gaines recalled. Assembling so many tales inevitably led to some near plagiarism. We swiped a few Ray Bradbury stories, and he caught us, Gaines once recalled with a laugh. But he was a real gentleman and wrote us a very nice letter suggesting that we had forgotten to pay him his royalties. When EC started to produce supernatural tales, they did it after the worst Holocaust that people had ever known, World War II, and the deaths of 6 million Jews in the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, noted Stephen King in an interview with Heavy Metal magazine. Indeed, a populace confronted with tales of Nazi atrocities was far less likely to respond to subtle gothic horror. The new sensibility demanded renditions of The Walking Dead in all their rotting glory. I don't know if anything has struck me as being scary besides the old EC stuff, which was definitely scary, commented artist and Continuity Comics publisher Neil Adams. EC horror comics were not simply compilations of ghoulish cliches, but subtle, satiric approaches to horror with genuine dilemmas and startling twist outcomes. Likewise, EC's science fiction and fantasy titles dealt with adult issues like racism and the meaning of progress. In part because of the higher quality material, EC soon assembled a stable of artists unparalleled in the industry then, and some argue ever. These series were rendered in a photorealistic art style seldom seen in comic books up to that time. They promoted their stable of illustrators, allowing each to sign their art, encouraging them to develop idiosyncratic styles, and by printing one-page biographies of them in the comic books. This was in stark contrast to the industry's common practice, in which credits were often missing and generic house styles were the norm. Each story was written and with the artist in mind, hence artists like Davis and Ingalls were given the more gruesome supernatural themed stories that fit their style, while artists like Kamen and Evans were given tamer material. Before long, EC attracted a stable of freelance artists and writers who have since become legends in the field. In EC stories, readers could easily identify the signed work of such artists as Graham Ingalls, Wally Wood, Jack Davis, Johnny Craig, Bernard Kringstein, Will Elder, Harvey Kurtzman, Al Feldstein, Jack Kamen, George Evans, Joe Orlando, John Severin, and Al Williamson. Other artists of note who worked for EC included Frank Fazetta, Basil Wolverton, and Reed Crandall.
And the other thing I just throw in there, not just the artists didn't just get credit and recognition, but they got paid better. Mm-hmm. The EC page rates were, I don't know exactly how much above the normal rates, but far above. Similar to what Quality Comics did in the 40s. They had the best rate, they got the best artists. But I also think you're right. They inspired those guys by giving them credit. You get something invested in what you're doing. That
sure,
well,
absolutely.
You can carve out your own sort of identity.
Graham Ingalls. What is Graham Ingalls referred to as? Well, he's ghastly, right?
Well, that's how he signed his work. And but fans wrote in demanding a story by this guy, or well, they want to see more of this or this guy. And they were talking about their art. So.
The message boards went crazy back then.
Yeah.
More Jack Davis.
Letters. As they nail letters to the board in the middle of town, the literal message board.
I think one of the other interesting things, and I just touched on it real briefly, was on the Ray Bradbury. And I love that he didn't sick the lawyers on them about, whiffing.
Beat the shit out of them with his own fist. That's what I was just saying.
He sent a very pleasant letter, said, hey, it's very nice of you guys to print my story. Right. You might want to pay me for
it. And subsequently, they did, in fact, buy stories from him and pay him royalties.
And they were some of the most popular EC comics of the time, and they would put based on a short story from Ray Bradbury, and it was turned into some of their hottest sellers.
Hot.
Well, I think the horror books sold better than everything, and the horror books pretty much sold everything else. They were able to do the war books and other books that didn't sell quite as
was it the horror, and then probably the science, the weird science stuff. I know that those were extremely popular, and that's where a lot of the Ray Bradbury stuff.
Yeah, but the horror were definitely the top.
Well, horror comics were the first successful instances of comics without a regular hero or heroine. In other words, Superman or a Little Lulu. But the EC Comics mags did have hosts. Like their radio inspirations, both of the first EC horror tales and everyone that followed were introduced by ghastly hosts who soon became known as the Ghoul Lunatics.
Sort of like Chris. He's a ghastly host.
He's from Chicago.
Yeah.
There were actually crime comics in the late 40s, but they weren't character based. They
right.
were story based, but yeah. It's similar.
Sorry. That's okay. Yeah, I just lost where I was at. The Crypt Keeper for the Crypt of Terror, later renamed Tales from the Crypt, the Vault Keeper for the Vault of Horror, and the Old Witch in the Haunt of Fear. Ghoulunatics welcomed the reader to each new tale and lobbed hideous puns in the last panel after a story which culminates in a come up and spy deep frying, the old witch remarks, hey, hey, and now my tale is done, kiddies. Well done. I hope it's left you with a ravishing appetite. The EC letter.
Yeah, now my kiddies.
I wasn't going to.
You weren't, huh?
No.
Well, leave it to me.
Yeah, well, no. Yeah. That's, you do it much better.
That's what we brought her in for.
We brought in the talent,
too. His witch voice.
Yeah. They brought in the old ghoul, basically.
Hello, this is Steve Niles, and you are listening to Around Comics.
The EC Letters pages overflowed with coherent reader correspondence responded
very smart listeners.
As opposed to normal comics.
Let's try to read this sentence.
Smarter
coherent
than me.
Coherent correspondence responded. What?
Coherent reader correspondence responded to by the Ghoulunatics. Part of what made EC attractive to readers was this fan-creator interplay. No matter what writer was responsible for the actual story, Feldstein wrote the Ghoulunatics dialogue. I remember back when I was young listening to The Witch's Tale on the radio, Feldstein told an EC convention crowd in 1972. Bill and I talked about it when I first became associated with him, and we decided we were going to put something like that into comics. By mid-1953, business at EC was astonishing, writes Maria Reidelbach in Completely Mad, A History of the Comic Book and Magazine. The Haunt of Fear, The Vault of Horror, and the renamed Tales from the Crypt had a circulation of 400,000 copies each. Weird Science, Weird Fantasy, Two-Fisted Tales, and Frontline Comet lagged behind at about 225,000 copies apiece. William Gates had turned his father's rickety little publishing house into a success and found a purpose in life at the same time. Imitators continued to spring up everywhere, some good, others just plain bad. The golden age of hero comics was over, and even Marvel Comics lurched from the hero format, converting its venerable Captain America into Captain America's Weird Tales, and then simply Weird Tales. One could hardly fault the industry for reacting so wholeheartedly. Even without a fan press to document the phenomena, or podcast, it was common knowledge that any kid worth his Chuck Taylors was willing to trade 3 Batmans or 5 True Romances for anything with a corpse on the cover.
Chuck Taylor wasn't really making shoes then, but okay.
Sorry. It was the oldest shoe I could think of.
Yeah,
how about
right.
Hush Puppies, maybe? Or
wooden clogs?
No, it would probably be
Chuck
not
Taylor's.
Keds. I'm thinking what came before Keds. But anyway, never mind. I'm not that right. old, thankfully.
Right. What did you wear before Chuck Taylor's? I didn't wear any. It was either...
I grew up wearing my Chucks, but,
It was leather-bottomed wingtips for everyone.
comic
Tom
reader.
Tom McCann's. That's
Tom
what
McCann's.
They were.
Tom
McCann's. I don't even think they make shoes anymore.
Comic readers, mainly young, school-age males, ate it up like ice cream. A typical horror comic sold three times as many copies as its romantic or superheroic counterparts. Gaines kept his staff small and the production levels high. Most of the illustrators were freelancers who at first were paid $18 per page for pencil work, $13 for inking. The fee later rose to about $50 a page. The income was, for Gaines, incomparable. According to a Senate testimony, EC's annual gross revenue by this time was about $1 million, the net $50,000. Not bad for books that went for 10 cents a copy. That meant they were selling about 10 million copies a year. It was also during this period that he and Harvey Kurtzman launched the legendary comic incarnation of Mad. Most competitors leapt aboard the horror wagon with more enthusiasm than ability. While EC Comics had their occasional moments of unmitigated tastelessness, Gaines and Company at least maintained a sense of humor that disarmed even the most disgusting tale. Despite the dubious quality of EC's peers, the late 1940s and early 1950s were the heyday of horror, and nothing could stop the party. Or so it seemed.
Yeah! Woohoo, get me! I'm leaping aboard the horror wagon! Yeah. But mostly with enthusiasm, not ability! Woohoo! Yeah!
Well, wrap your head around those numbers for a second. 10 million copies a year.
Yeah, I mean, you had three titles selling 400,000 or more, and then the other copies are two and a quarter. That's unbelievable. I mean,
think about
Ten million juvenile delinquents reading comic books.
Oh yeah, yeah. The country was going to hell in a handbasket. You know, to put it, in today's terms, Tom, you're more of our numbers guy, but yeah. Civil War number one sold 300,000 copies.
Yeah, just a little bit over 300,000.
And those numbers started going down rapidly after that, yeah. Whereas these were consistently 400,000.
A really high-selling book now, like if you're over 100,000, is considered a pretty high-selling.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the
Tom, special. You're the numbers guy?
I'm an accountant.
Okay.
Scary, isn't it?
Look 100, at us, too.
100,000 is pretty much a pretty big threshold for what's considered a huge hit and, you know.
You know, but and then they talk about the other companies that were starting to put out the other horror titles, and what we're getting ready to get into is kind of the aftermath of that, and just from a couple documentaries I've seen and what I've read is that the story started to get more gruesome. And
well,
it
sure,
was,
you have
it was
escalation. I mean, it's like they have to, you know, the natural competition is going to make things escalate to the point where
it was
sooner or later.
First,
you
chop off
point.
Your wife's head. Eventually, you're decorating your Christmas tree with your entrails. Exactly. You know, yeah, I mean, right. You gotta go somewhere. You gotta go up.
You can sooner only the later. Kids will only buy that same chopping up your spouse story.
Exactly.
So many times.
Well, exactly. I mean, they were churning out so many stories. I mean, you're looking. These were 36 page
32
books.
32 generally.
And
32, 34.
Yeah, so they're like think. Three stories a book. You know, you're looking. You know, it was only and
which is something I wanted to bring up because someone on our forum. It said that they really loved the idea of the archives, but they were reluctant to pay the price for six issues.
Yeah.
But you have to remember, six issues means it's over 200 pages. They're not 22-page comic books. Six issues of they're 32 plus other
extras. Totally the hardcover Russ Cochran?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These
oh,
are the,
buy them.
Yeah.
They're awesome.
Oh, yeah.
They look fantastic.
It's like getting the original art. I mean, it's beautiful reproductions from the actual originals, which Gaines kept.
Yeah.
I mean, that
yeah.
is a thick
one of the
book.
Few people to do that.
And if you get it off in stock trades, it'll be
30%.
Really it's like 32 or $35.
Yeah, they're like something 32 like something a piece.
But well worth it. Well worth it.
Well, all this success made EC a big target. Beginning in the late 1940s, the comic book industry became the target of mounting public criticism for the content of comic books and their potentially harmful effects on children. The problem came to a head in 1948 with the publication of Dr. Frederick Wortham's two articles, House in the Nursery in Collars Weekly. Horror in the Nursery from Collars Weekly. And The Psychopathology of Comic Books from the American Journal of Psychotherapy. A storm of criticism broke out around comic books. In response, a group of publishers, including Gaines, created the Association of Comic Magazine Publishers, the ACMP. The association released their Publisher's Code, drawing on the Hollywood Production Code, better known as the Hays Code, which had also been drafted to stave off external regulation. Like the production code, it forbid portrayals of crime that might throw sympathy against the law or weaken respect for established authority, and prohibited ridicule or attack of any religious or racial group. Sexy wanton sex, or sexy wanton comics, sexy wanton sex, my favorite kind of sex, sexy wanton comics,
sexy wanton sex,
were not to be published, and divorce was not to be treated humorously or represented as glamorous or alluring.
They came out with Glamorous Divorce Magazine.
I gotta say, if you've never read the actual comics code, it's hilarious to read it. I mean, because, you know, it's so literal. You can't do this, you can't do that, she can't do that with him while they're drinking this. Oh, it's very fun.
Divorce never portrays divorce as glamorous. Is that a huge problem in the EC titles?
Well, they didn't divorce, they killed each other.
Yeah, they killed each other.
Divorce. The big divorce was annulled by knife
by murder.
Yeah.
Comics that complied with the code were offered a seal of approval. The code, however, was not a success, ignored by both large and small publishers. Some publishers, such as Dell Comics, refused to join the organization. Others, such as founding member EC Comics, terminated their participation. Those who continued as members made use of the ACMP seal of approval without any formal process of review. Describing the situation in 1950, Director Schultz said, "The association, I would say, is out of business, and so is the code." Nevertheless, comics continued to be printed with the association seal for the next few years.
Was this kind of the dry run of the Comics Code Authority?
Well, it was their own. I mean, they
Well, so created, was the Comics
well,
Code. It was self-policing.
Yeah, they were trying to do a preemptive strike, really, is what they were trying
so
to do.
So it was one of those things where you try and do a preemptive strike, but until you actually sort of get freaked out.
Nailed
it
to the wall.
Won't really stick.
Yeah.
You know, like, you'd be like, you know it's coming, but until it hits you.
This should, yeah, it's like, well, this'll tide, you know, yeah. Tide it over. Well, you know, but code or no code, Dr. Wortham took it upon himself to illuminate and eliminate the harm he felt was being done to young comic book readers. Wortham attacked all comics with zeal, but had a particular axe to grind with crime and horror titles. He lobbied unsuccessfully for legislation to prohibit sales of comic books to individuals under the age of 15. He failed to arouse any substantial public outcry until 1953, when an excerpt in Ladies' Home Journal previewed the publishing of his manifesto, The Seduction of the Innocent. Parents were shocked at what they read and saw. Batman and Robin were plainly homosexual,
oh.
Wortham proclaimed, as was Wonder Woman. Lurid what? Pictures culled from comics depicted acts of depravity and torture that modern youth will surely emulate, Wortham warned.
All 10 million of them.
When Seduction was finally published, it was reviewed by the major media outlets of the day and provoked newsstand boycotts and pressure to control the comic book menace. Public comic book burnings were so common that part of the current value of an EC comic can be directly linked to its avoidance of these bonfires.
Hey, let's go burn all our copies of Justice Society of America number one.
The fascinating thing about this guy's methods, right, his documentation. He worked with kids, troubled kids.
Mm-hmm.
They all read comics. He said he noticed that they would all have that comic book rolled up in their back pocket. Well, 10 million readers were all kids.
Yeah.
Kids read comics.
All kids had it.
Juvenile delinquents read comics, and kids who weren't.
Good kids, yeah, sure.
Well, it's like, you know, kids with shoes. Kids with shoes
kids
are growing.
Kids with shoes are, you know, yeah, right. It's horrible.
Well, someone needs to figure out a way to make these shoes responsible for themselves.
Chuck Taylor, were they Chuck Taylor? They weren't Chuck Taylors. They were.
Anyway. Old Man McCann's?
Tom McCann. Tom McCann's, you young whippersnapper.
Tom McCann's.
Tom McCann's loafers.
You never heard of Tom McCann's?
I have, actually. Because
he's from Wisconsin.
Yes.
On June 1st,
<That's the reason.
laughs> on June 1st, 1953, the Senate Subcommittee to Investigate Juvenile Delinquency in the United States was created, led by anti-crime crusader Estes
Kefauver.
Its mission was to take a second look at the possible influence of so-called crime comic books. Dr. Wortham seized upon the opportunity to further his crusade and testified on April 21, 1954. In extensive testimony before the committee, Wortham restated arguments from his book and pointed to comics as a major cause of juvenile crime. As the testimony from other parties wore on, it became obvious that a scapegoat was being constructed to which the scourge of juvenile delinquency could be pinned. Did I say Scourge right?
Yes, that would be the Scourge.
Scourge, yeah, sorry. The target was so large, anyone with an opinion stood in line to lob grenades.
Was juvenile delinquency that horrible in the 50s? Well, like,
you had, like, Billy Batson kids running around homeless.
Yeah, running into fucking chain tunnels whenever someone convinces them to do it, I guess.
I think it was a big concern for the public. And maybe it was one of those things where drugs became later. You know, all of a sudden, white kids are taking drugs. Maybe there were more white kids involved in juvenile delinquency. I don't know, but people did get upset about it.
Do you think part of it is because of the burgeoning media at that time? I mean, with television and radio and how
bars.
That kind of message could...
It's post-war America. There's a lot more money flooding into, you know, the country, so kids were not working. They were out there
causing trouble.
Around.
Yeah.
You know, these are social changes.
Damn,
they
were surviving childhood.
Yeah. And then they were reading comics, so their minds were warped.
Well, they're driving out to make out point, and they hadn't done that before.
I just think that, you know, because you know, all of a sudden you were able to get this message across to millions of people that, you know, a lot quicker than ever before, the overreaction of it.
It also became
maybe
a country of, like, you know, it's not just kids had a lot of free time. You know, adults had a lot of free time.
Okay, well, we're arguing whether there was juvenile delinquency or not. We're not experts on that, just like this guy was not expert on comics.
Sure, yeah.
And he never bothered to actually document, do statistics and analysis of what kids were actually
reading. He wrote a book, and it got into the
comic culture. He was an expert with quotations around it. But the fact is that, you know, I mean, why does anybody do anything? We don't know. But what they did is comics published material that you couldn't see on television at the time and you couldn't see in the theaters. So it was ahead of its time in terms of content. Mm-hmm. You didn't have violent murders being, you know, in comics, they sit there. In a movie, there might be a second of a knife flashing, but in comics, you can look at that
over and over, yeah.
Lovingly rendered gore and violence as he did so well. But I think they were just, you know, people were crazy
reactionary
about communism.
People are reactionary.
Then.
Yeah, fear in general was rampant in a lot of different...
Start burning things and running people out of town, Hollywood, whatever.
I think a lot of it is that the world was changing, and people fear change, and this is one of the things that they anchored their fears to, I think is probably...
Sure. Well, it's like anything. You see the same thing with... video games now.
You see it today.
In the 80s when all those experts came out and said there was cults everywhere in America.
Wortham was sincere. Yeah. A lot of the politicians who used his ideas were not sincere. They were the usual opportunists. But he himself was sincere. To his dying day, he kept in correspondence with different comic book people. Interesting guy.
And who's to say he wasn't completely right?
Yeah, I'm so fucking twisted because of all the comic books I've read.
Well, now it doesn't matter because comics are so tame compared to films and, you know, I mean,
right,
you can download
absolutely.
Porn all day if you want. Not that I recommend that.
This is Gene Colan, and you are listening to Around Comics.
Bill Gaines couldn't stomach simply observing the proceedings any longer. He asked to testify before the subcommittee and was granted the privilege. Gaines was a successful businessman, but a poor politician, and his decision to appear before the subcommittee was a blunder. Gaines took credit for publishing the first horror comic, which he did not, and compared Wortham's understanding of comic books to a frigid old maid's understanding of sex.
That went over really, really well.
Yeah, that was very good.
By his own admission, Gaines stumbled when he defended the cover art for one of his books. The cover depicted a woman's severed head, and when asked if the cover was in good taste, Gaines said it was. The only way it would have been in bad taste, he said, was if it showed gore dripping from the head. Gaines didn't tell the senators that a rejected version of that cover had done just that. On a positive note, during his Senate appearance, he was shown a copy of the Shock Suspense stories then on the newsstand. In that issue was a fable called The Orphan, in which the girl's torturer ends up in the electric chair. Gaines was asked sarcastically if he thought the story had any therapeutic value for children. Instead of twisting some moral rationalization out of his scare tale, Gaines sensibly replied, "I don't think it does them a bit of good, but I don't think it does them a bit of harm either."
In these Senate hearings, it was just one pitfall after another for him. Because he went there and he tried to answer.
He was also on amphetamines, and he was really in bad physical shape. So he was, you know, I mean... The Senate hearings of the 50s, the anti-commie theories.
They were all witch hunts. I mean, they were all, you know.
Yeah, and they weren't fair presentations of anything.
They kept standing him up to knock him down, and he walked into every one of them.
Well, he went there in good faith, thinking that he could change people's minds, but not realizing maybe the reality of it and what kind of a bear trap it was. But
well, you know, if you're gonna have a hearing about whether or not EC Comics has like people with severed heads in it, and you're like, if that's your justification for getting rid of it, and you show someone a picture of a severed head, I mean, like, what's he going to say?
How do you defend
that's not
it?
A severed head. You
but
know, like,
you know, even defending that cover, though, it literally wasn't shown. I mean, the neckline was cut off, and then you saw the body at an angle behind it. You didn't see the severed neck either. So in both cases, it was implied. So you put it together. They did. They were trying to have some sort of sense of
was there
whatever that is.
Was there any
I guess.
Glorification of divorce in that issue or in that cover?
Well, again, I think that in that cover, it probably was a husband who just killed his wife. Yeah,
divorced her from her
body.
No,
they went around. Yeah, the divorce laws. They went around the divorce laws again. You know,
again,
this is the old-fashioned biblical divorce, right? All this lightning would strike her down.
She turns
into
the
a pillar of salt.
Gaines had volunteered to testify as a way of putting his case to the people. It didn't help, even though no legislation resulted from the hearings. Horror comics got buried in harsh publicity. Public opinion began to stack squarely against the comic industry. Though the committee's final report did not blame comics for crime, it recommended that the comics industry tone down its content voluntarily. Possibly taking this as a veiled threat of potential censorship, the majority of comic book publishers formed the Comic Magazine Association of America, the CMAA. The now familiar Comics Code Authority stamp was introduced to great fanfare and publicity. All comics would be submitted to an independent review panel before publication, and only those books that were deemed wholesome enough for the eyes of the nation's youth were allowed the stamp of approval. The Comics Code represented the kiss of death for EC's line of horror and suspense comics. Not only did the new rules forbid the use of the words horror or terror in a title, but explicitly specified that scenes dealing with or instruments associated with The Walking Dead, torture, vampires, and vampirism, ghouls, cannibalism, and werewolfism were prohibited. Pretty much everything that was in an EC comic and made them good.
Where's the fun in that?
You can't have a werewolf.
Yeah, they basically took every EC book and took the titles of the books and said, you can't use these words.
And you can't torture a vampire, too, or a werewolf. Yeah. Like, come on.
Vampire rights, man.
You can,
vampire rights.
If there's anyone you should be able to torture, I mean, it's a vampire or a werewolf.
Or a cannibal. My God, if you're a cannibal, you deserve
you
to be tortured.
Be able to eat a cannibal.
On a cover, even.
That's a logical conundrum. Then you become a
2 days, and you have to eat yourself. Oh.
Someone.
Two days before the CMAA was officially established, Gaines announced that he was suspending publication of his horror and suspense comics. An era had ended. As quickly as they had risen, the EC horror comics fell.
Bill Gaines was all about the Comics Code to begin with. He met with other publishers, was going to voluntarily enter it, he was going to try and organize them to...
Yeah, that's in the next part. Enforcement was voluntary, and publishers could choose to publish without the code seal of approval, as Gaines did at first. But when skittish distributors refused to carry his comics, he gave in. And after a year of struggling with code dictates, he quit entirely. By the beginning of 1956, EC had completely vacated the comics racks.
They turned on him. That's the other publisher.
Yeah, he initially thought... Yeah, he was part of it and initially thought it was going to be okay, but he quickly learned that it was... Yeah, I mean, it was almost designed entirely to get rid of EC Comics.
Well, it was... The Comics Code attacked exactly what EC was doing, and it was all the other publishers basically got together, and if you get all your competition in one room and say, you know what? With this, we can get rid of our biggest competitor.
Yeah.
And they steamrolled him.
Fuckers.
It's a harsh business.
Publishing.
Where's torture and cannibalism when you need it, huh?
Yeah.
With the threat of government censorship as their excuse, the code became an instrument the larger publishers could use to eliminate some of their competition. Gaines canceled the entire EC line except for Mad Magazine. It survived because it didn't look like a comic book, and so it wasn't a target, which didn't mean children weren't reading it. He became the fat, funny face of Mad, aside from Alfred E. Newman. EC's most lasting legacy came with Mad, which started as a side project for Harvey Kurtzman before booming the company's fortunes and becoming a remarkably significant humor publication. A sister publication, Panic, was also produced when humor magazines were the industry rage in 1954. Many of the artists and writers from the new trend era promptly found work in EC's Mad and Panic magazines. There, the EC style lived on in the form of Wicked parody and Razor Wit. Oddly enough, the drawing styles of Will Elder, Jack Davis, Al Feldstein, and John Severn were first encountered by many baby boomers via Mad paperbacks and reprints in the 1960s and early 70s, making their serious work in the earlier EC horror titles seem incongruous. Incongruous at first to the average under 40 reader who has worked backward through history. Still, EC's new trend line stands the test of time nearly a half century after their original publication date. Luckily, EC has found a large audience embracing its humor comics, Mad and Panic. Mad always sold well throughout the company's troubles, and Gaines focused exclusively on publishing Mad in magazine form. This move was done to placate its editor, Harvey Kurtzman, who had received an offer to join the magazine pageant, but preferred to remain in charge of his own magazine. More crucially, the switch had the happy result of moving Mad from the auspicious... God, I gotta quit putting big words in this shit.
The auspices
of the Comics Code. While no EC comic book lasted 6 years, Mad has been publishing without interruption for over 50. Though Kurtzman did not last long with Mad after this point, leaving when Gaines wouldn't give him a 51% control of the magazine, Gaines brought back Al Feldstein as his replacement. The magazine enjoyed unrivaled success for decades afterwards. Gaines continued to publish Mad until 1961, when he sold it to Premier Industries. In 1968, it was acquired by Warner Communications, one of the companies that eventually wheeled and dealed to become AOL Time Warner. That media mega conglomerate owns it today, along with DC Comics, Time Warner, MGM, and the Hanna-Barbera cartoons and other major Toon properties. The Tales from the Crypt title was licensed for a movie in 1972 and more successfully for a TV series in the 1980s. William Gaines died in 1992, but his legacy lives on throughout comics culture and modern comic shops.
I have to say that I read Mad Magazine when I was a kid, and a lot of my knowledge of movies that came out that I never saw come merely from the parodies in Mad Magazine. Sure. I've never seen any of the movies, but I recognize them from the Mad Magazine.
Well, I think what's interesting out of all this is that, you know, Bill Gaines is one of the more important architects of comic books. But he's more widely known as being the man behind Mad Magazine. I think that's very interesting that has kind of been his legacy. And
Mad is a comic magazine.
Has it ever been late? I was really curious, and I said, I don't know.
In 50 years,
has Mad ever missed a deadline?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
I don't think so.
Well, yeah, you
are curious. The numbers guy.
Yeah, I am the numbers guy. I need to know.
But I think that, you know, and that's maybe the distinction. Do people look at Mad and have looked at Mad as more of a magazine as opposed to a comic book? I mean, that's why he left EC Comics, is because Mad could be sold on newsstands as a magazine as opposed as a comic. And that's
also
why it got out from under
point
the Comics
was
code.
Different. They were able to sell it for more money.
Even though it was black and white, which is funny, but it was bigger.
So they made a much bigger profit margin, I imagine. I don't know the answer exactly, but...
I think.
What was the question again?
Is Mad more of a magazine? You know, I don't think it's important, but you know.
I think people shop for it differently.
When people say comics, they usually do mean superhero.
Yeah.
Now, but they also probably think of like four color or what used to be the four color comic.
Sure. You know. Sure.
What do they call them now? Pamphlets or the little comic books?
Digest.
No,
floppies.
Yeah,
floppies.
I've heard pamphlets for the non-trade paperback collection.
Singles, floppies, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, although the last non-Mad EC publication came out in 1956, EC Comics have remained popular for half a century, thanks much in part to the reprints that have kept them in the public eye. Some of the many EC reprints include the following. Ballantine Books published 5 paperbacks between 1964 and 1966. The EC Horror Comic Library, published by Nostalgia Press in 1971. The EC Portfolios in 1971 and 1977. East Coast Comics reprinted in comic form a number of EC New Trends comics between 1973 and 1975. The Complete EC Library, a project of Russ Cochran's that started in 1978, reprinted every single EC comic in hardbound volumes. And EC Classics, this group of magazine-sized reprints from Russ Cochran appeared between 1985 and 1989. Throughout the 1990s and 2000, almost EC's entire line of comics were reprinted in comic form. The first group of reprints came from Gladstone in 1990, which reprinted various issues of the three horror comics, the sci-fi comics, and crime suspense stories in 64-page issues. A total of 18 issues would be published. The second group of reprints, known as the RCP, Russ Cochran Publisher reprints, appeared the next year and also reprinted various issues from the horror, sci-fi, and crime comics. Starting in 1992, the comics were reprinted in chronological order in a 32-page form. This line eventually reprinted every new trend and new direction comic except for Mad and many pre-trend comics as well. And in 2006, Russ Cochran announced the beginning of a new project, a series of hardcover color reprint sets called the EC Archives.
And they are fantastic.
Yes, they are. So, yeah, you know, in doing my research for this piece, I really was kind of blown away by how influential William Gaines and EC Comics were. I mean, I always had heard of EC Comics, and I occasionally had read some here and there, but I never really had a sense of how much of an impact that company and those comics and William Gaines had on the comic book industry. I mean, really looking at the history of EC Comics is really
the history of
the history of comics to some degree, and it's amazing that as much as I've been around comics for 20 years and reading them and enjoying them, I never really knew any of it, and it's kind of sad in some ways that they don't maybe get the mainstream attention that I think they should, but hopefully with the reprints and that they're still around and people talk about them and more people will get turned on to them. So I know I have now been, you know, with the archives, I can't get enough of it.
Thank goodness for Russ Cochran.
Yeah, he's really kept EC around for 40 years now, 50 years almost.
You're listening to Around Comics. It's like talking to your best friend's sister, and she's hot.
Well, you know, one of the main reasons that we asked Hillary to be here is...
He worked for EC back in 1948.
Yeah, whenever you sold it to Bill Gaines. No,
I wiped the blood off the floor, mostly.
I wrote the 12-issue Moses story. And
it was a maxi-series.
The Tales of Young Moses. Before he got his powers, yeah.
If you're familiar with Hillary's work, you can see a direct line between what was done at EC and your work. I mean,
are you saying he's
stealing?
Yeah, he just lifted all that stuff.
He aped from the best.
Influences. They're called influences.
If you admit to my mistake, it's an influence.
I'm tracing my influences.
But you can obviously see the influence. I mean, why don't you put in words what EC influenced you
what
in your style?
What did EC mean to you?
Yes.
Well, my first, probably most profound influence from EC was the paperback collections that they put out in the 60s, and seeing Wally Wood and all the guys in Mad, not the horror comics, mind you, but in Mad. That was the first time I saw that stuff, and I fell in love with it. But comics at the time were more, for me, Marvel, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, those kind of people. So that was the comics I was reading and thinking of as comics, but I kind of grew into the EC influence. And by the time the 70s came around, when I started drawing...
Doing drugs.
Yeah. Watching other people do drugs. But the undergrounds came up. But people like Bernie Wrightson, who were obviously inspired by Graham Ingalls, Jack Davis, and the EC horror line and science fiction line, you know, Swamp Thing and books like that. I mean, there's all this stuff that was more illustrative, more like the EC line, and not just superheroes. And I don't know, that influence came back for me. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I think actually it's gotten profounder over the years. My best friend was in love with Wally Wood. He collected his artwork in every comic Wally ever drew and inked, and I think that had an influence on me, too. Every time we would go over there and talk, the guy would be showing me more Wally Wood stuff. So it was just, I just absorbed it. And I mean, I can't get away from it now. If I sit down and draw, I don't have to look at Wally Wood. I can just draw, oh, yeah, Wood would put the shadow there, that kind of thing.
Is he your biggest influence out of that whole EC troop?
I think so. I mean, I love other artists there, but Wood there's something about Wood's technique that's right there in your face. He was one of the most influential inkers in comics, but also designers. I mean, his science fiction, you know, gimmick, you know, his little machinery, his, you know, little everything looked like the grill on a Chevy or something from the 50s, you know. Yeah. It was just people, that's when they think of science fiction for years, that's what they would draw.
Sure.
And I still do it just because I love that stuff. It's just cool, you know. It's just, it's fun comics.
Do you think there was, I'm sorry, Tom.
I was just going to mention, when you mentioned Swamp Thing, I mean, made me think of our year of Alan Moore and how we just read Swamp Thing last month. And you can see a lot of the EC. There's sort of a...
Oh, yeah. That first trade, I think I had mentioned it before. Because I had...
That was an EC story.
Yeah, that first issue, I mean, that, you know, it's a straight-up horror EC, even with the twist ending.
I mean, it was
and,
brilliant,
and everything.
But it was an EC story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously they were hearkening back to that.
He's not this, he's this. And then
right.
They were supposed to be like, oh, and that's the twist ending at the end where you realize what the Swamp Thing really is as opposed to what you thought it was going into.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was an interesting sort of...
Do you think, and you had sort of touched on it, Hillary, with how their work was more illustrative. And, you know, you look at it now compared to other comic work or, you know, that came later, like I said, Ditko and Kirby, and how it wasn't, you know, it didn't have that action to it that comics of that time did, but there was something else there. I mean, there was such a depth to that work.
Well, I think the difference maybe in the art, some of the difference in the art with say, superhero comics, which predominate the market today, stems from the fact that these stories were not action stories per se. They weren't about characters flying around, jumping around, punching each other. They were more about people in real environments, and it lent itself to art that where you could handle that stuff, and you could make it dramatically compelling to have someone standing in a room. Well, how do you do that? It's not by drawing rippling muscles. You draw light. You do lighting and mood and atmosphere. It's the shot, the angle. All that stuff became important, and you know, basically Wood studied under Eisner and Kniff and people like that. He actually worked for Eisner, and he took the cinematic stuff that Eisner brought into comics and storytelling and lighting, and he pushed it in his own direction. And all the other artists did the same thing. They were all really talented illustrators, and they were serving stories. If you ask someone to do a story where people are knocking down buildings for 16 pages, it's probably going to be more about grand action and not about nuance of character.
Where the camera is.
And it's not that Kirby came along later. I mean, he was doing stuff, you know, congruently with them. Kirby was, you know, working in the, you know, the 40s, Captain America. And
they did their horror comics themselves, Simon and Kirby, and romance comics and all that kind of stuff that would be closer to non-superhero genres. Right. Ditko also, yes.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Yeah,
John Centris was like, Ditko.
Ditko.
Ditko. Don't forget Ditko.
Listen, assholes.
Well, definitely, I feel it definitely leads, it lends itself to sort of study of it almost more so than the superhero stuff of the time, only because, like I said, it's not stories about a bunch of action going on or these, you know, super powered beings. It's much more subtle, and in retrospect, you know, it sort of gives you more to look at.
Well, I don't even know if you guys know this, but the boards, the EC boards, were lettered. The art boards that the artist drew those comics on were lettered before the artist got the script. They got the script and the boards at the same time, and they drew around those balloons. And there were only a few artists. Bernie Krigstein, who was primarily interested in panel breakdown, just totally hated that. So when he got certain stories, he would cut up the balloons and the pages and reassemble them to do his little tiny panel breakdowns. But if you look at everyone else, there's a format there, and that was dictated by Feldstein.
Right.
And when Kurtzman did his books, he actually gave layouts to the artist. He didn't letter mad. He didn't have the boards pre-lettered, but they had the book laid out by Kurtzman. He did his thumbnail layouts for the artist. So there was an editorial dictate about how the stories were told, and you know, you couldn't do diagonal panels and 16 panels on a page. It was much more 6 panels on a page.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
that's story,
what I've noticed in reading the archives and other stuff that I've been able to find, is that you know when you're reading an EC book. It is a, I don't want to say format, but you know it's an EC book. There is a common, you know, a common thread that runs through them.
Right, and if you look at the horror books, if you look at what Feldstein wrote in general, I mean, it does get a little tiresome after a while. Not because he overwrote. You can overwrite in a good way. But it's just the format does become a little wearying. You know, it's, okay, we got a paragraph of copy. Sometimes it's redundant with the artwork describing what's there.
There's
the
a lot of exposition.
Right, and... You know, but these guys, you really look at it as a place where illustrators flowered and developed their drawing styles. I don't know. It's not necessarily the greatest comics in terms of storytelling. I mean, Krigstein could only do what he did by tearing up that format. You know, he broke rules, literally. Tore up pages.
Literally broke the rules.
He ripped them up. Yeah.
Well, why do you think they were so influential? In
future, Jesus.
Just a nutshell, why in 2007 are we so excited that the EC archives are coming out? Why are they relevant today, I guess?
Well, that's a good question.
They look good.
People still want to kill their wives, I think.
I'm a newlywed.
They want to get divorced.
They're beautifully, beautifully drawn, and there are many wonderfully, you know, twisted, funny horror stories, wonderful science fiction allegories, and they are good tales. You know, they're really good tales, drawn by great illustrators and good comic artists. I mean, these guys. It's amazing when you know that they were given the format and the panels ruled out and the balloons there. What they were able to do within that rigid format.
Well, I think it's interesting because in reading those stories, you almost expect the stories to have been reprinted almost for a kitsch value or look at how ironic it is to read these old stories. But they actually sort of surpass that expectation of being like, it's not just retro. At times, the stories actually have an interesting twist.
Well, their own commentary is built in. The horror stories they're cackling at the stories. I mean, you mentioned Gaines talking about Witch's Tale. I mean, they did this stuff in the 40s on radio. You know, there was Inner Sanctum with Raymond the Gay Ghoul. And they would sort of send up the horror genre as you're enjoying that genre.
Yeah.
So, you know, to make fun of it now, what are you making fun of? They knew they were already making grisly.
It's such an interesting thing to read this because you would say, if someone were to hand you a 1950s, you know, without someone who doesn't know anything about it and say, here's a 1950s horror book, you would think, well, this is some retro chic.
It's not going to hold up.
It's not going to hold up in any level.
When I first started reading the archives, I was most amazed at how well. It never entered my mind that these were, you know, old comic, that these were written, you know, 50 years ago. They were so sort of still, I don't want to say relevant because of the genre, but they held up so well. There were stories in there that were just still, you know, kind of mind blowing and just amazing.
Yeah.
It
could be today if only men wore hats.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And everyone smoked.
Well, I think you see that
as opposed to just
in. The TV show on HBO, Tales from the Crypt, that they updated the stories. They took these, you know, these 40s and 50s stories. They just updated them a little bit, and they're the same
really
stories.
Yeah, really just the, you know, sort of
the dress.
The costumes and some
well,
of the talk.
Well, I think a lot of the concepts, you see it even dressed up. I mean, there's sort of like, the whole idea of like sort of a twisted science goes all the way back to like Frankenstein. You know, that sort of whole sort of. Creating something that destroys.
But these were groundbreaking comics. I mean, again, we were talking about the Senate hearings and all that, and the Comics Code. There wasn't anything like this before EC. I mean, there were crime comics, and there were comics that parents probably saw and threw in the garbage. You know, when they found them in their kids' room. But these comics, you know, touching on horror and science fiction, nothing was ever like that in comics. So they were new.
Sure.
They were exciting. Yeah. That isn't there today. I mean, you're reading now, and you're more appreciating just the quality of the craft now.
Yeah.
There isn't the novelty isn't there, but they were new and mad. You talk about you're not really looking at the stuff as an antique. When Saturday Night Live did a parody of Mad, I don't know if you guys ever saw that episode. They did a parody of Mad when it became generic. You know, now you pick up Mad. They've tried to change it in recent years, but up until a few years ago. You would read those movie parodies, and it's like you were reading the parody you read 30 years ago. They just plug a different movie in.
Sure. Yeah.
And they parodied the format. Well, Mad, when it first started, did not have a format. I think Mad, one of the reasons Mad succeeded, it truly was the most groundbreaking thing that EC ever did. And there's no, you know, I mean, Kurtzman was the genius there, you know.
I have a hard time remembering, but I think Mad, you know, and books like that were really what got me into comics in the first place. I was reading those before I was reading comic books, just for the, you know, sort of sick, twisted humor. Yeah. And
Mad taught kids something that I wish a lot of kids would learn today, to actually look at the world around them, not just accept it as, we're good consumers, and we accept what government tells us. Mad told you to look at everything skeptically.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Don't trust what they tell you in an advertisement, in a speech, you know, whatever. And that's a pretty profound lesson for a kid to learn at a young age.
What was that when you said? Because I read Mad Magazine at the same time I started reading comics, and I used to get all the like reprint books because my grandfather used to really like Mad Magazine, and I never considered them the same. For whatever reason, in my own mind, they were two completely separate things in my own head. Even though they're not really in my head, they were just it wasn't the same.
You know, I remember reading Mad stuff and seeing Severin's work in it, and I always remember thinking gosh, how come he doesn't do comic books? You know, it wasn't until
he was Iron Fist number 2, by the way.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky enough that the first time I was inked at Marvel, it was by John Severin.
Really?
Yeah, my editor, Carl Potts, said, Hillary, would you like to be inked by Kevin Nolan or John Severin? And that was a tough choice, but not that tough for me, because I knew Kevin was going to be around forever, you know.
You're going to get another shot with Kevin.
This is John Severin, and I was doing, this was on What The, so it was a Mad-type parody book anyway, at least aspired to be. So there was really no choice there. Kevin inked me on other things later, which was great, but, yeah.
Hey, Severin's still doing stuff.
Absolutely.
Still
at 84.
His last issue sold out. I always thought of Severin as the John Ford of comics. He did crappy Western comics at Marvel, you know, or Atlas Comics in the early 60s after EC collapsed. He stayed in comics. He never left comics. Mm-hmm. And he went on to Cracked. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't go back to Mad.
I hated Cracked when I was a kid.
Yeah. Well, but he drew brilliantly there. The writing suffered. But anyway, he drew these Westerns, and they're just, like, so great. They're just, you know, one dull story after another, mostly, but he just drew everything professionally every time out. Guys, he's fantastic.
No, like I said, I mean, he was really one of the first artists, you know, or cartoonists or illustrators that I ever really took notice of as a kid in that stuff, and I just ate it up. I mean, I just was amazed at what he was doing compared to anybody else, what they were doing in those books.
Yeah.
It just was unbelievable. And like I said, it was kind of funny. Later I found out, you know, he had done all this other comic work I had no idea about. But
when he inked me, not to belabor this too much, but one of the funniest things, and I love this, is he was such a careful guy. I would pencil a figure, and I thought I put it every shadow, and I forgot to put a shadow in somewhere. He would put it in. He wouldn't change the art. He didn't redraw anything. He'd go, oh, he missed that. And this was the Pulverizer, you know, parody of the Punisher. Yeah. So he's like punching a bunch of guys out, beating up on a bunch of guys in every other page. And there's this one big scene in a bar where all these guys are laying there after the Pulverizer has, you know, knocked them out. And so I put little X's in their eyes, meaning they were knocked out in comic book, you know, language.
He drew their eyes in.
He blacked in their eyes in. Because that's same symbol I was marking all the shadows for the inker to put in. And I found that so charming. These were tiny little eyes that he blacked in.
They're X's.
Like, I wouldn't bother. Yeah, I wouldn't fill it in myself. He was going, oh, he wants us blacked in. And it was like, he's so careful and professional a guy.
Oh, fucking
he was blacking in those little eyes.
Why does Hillary Barr want
that? That charming, you know, it didn't bother me at all. I was like, oh, I love that.
Yeah,
I wouldn't change it for the world.
Nice.
Fucking Hillary Barr blacking out tiny eyes.
I don't understand it, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Well, do you guys have any last thoughts on EC or the or legacy of EC Comics?
If you haven't read EC stuff, you know, and you can, go check out those archives because it really is great stuff, and it is an illustrative history of comic books and a huge, huge part of the history
and
of comics.
And there are books on the stands now. Fear Agent is one that I've worked on writing stories for, and others. You guys might be able to name them.
Something like Walking Dead, which is like a zombie book.
Well, I think anything, you know, horror-related or just that twisting, you know, you don't see as much of it
Sometimes I see a little bit of it.
There's plenty of EC in the Treehouse of Horror that they put out every
little
year,
twists
pretty
at the
much.
End.
And
which you have been an author and illustrator of?
Yeah, that's not why I mentioned it, but yes. Bernie Wrightson just did a story for them, and in fact, I think John Severin just inked something.
Did he?
Maybe this year or last year.
Oh, Dan Centra says Gene Colan.
And Gene Colan.
Get your own show,
on Centra's. And on.
But if you have a chance, go. It's really worth the effort.
A couple resources. I want to mention. First of all, Bill Jourdain's fantastic Golden Age of Comics podcast. He's done a couple. He did an EC cast, but he also did some Weird Science cast. So Bill
Weird
Jourdain.
Science.
If you're interested in Golden Age comic books, his podcast is fantastic. And also, I mentioned it a little bit. If you buy the Tales from the Crypt Season 1 DVD, there is a second disc included in that that has a fantastic one-hour EC Comics documentary on it, which is well worth picking that up.
Yes, for. I was very disappointed to find out that that existed because when we were talking to Russ Cochran, or before we were going to talk to Russ Cochran, and I was doing all this research, I'm like, man, there really should be a documentary about EC Comics.
There
and
is
I
one.
Found out
there,
like, was
there is one.
One.
There is one.
I guess which, I was happy, shit. But I also disappointed.
And
you look like a dick.
Man or whoever.
Ron.
Who made it?
Yeah, I forget the. You know, there's somebody who did in the couple comic books.
Whoever you are, sir.
Anyway.
And speaking of Russ Cochran, if you are interested in hearing the vanguard of EC Comics, well, guess what? We did an interview with Russ Cochran, and you will be able to hear that when, Sal?
Hopefully tomorrow, Friday. I will hopefully have that done, and you'll be able to listen to it. I should have it done. If not, I'll get it up like Saturday or something.
Yeah, so don't fucking bitch about it.
It's going to be a bonus episode.
It's
going
to be free.
We talked to like Russ last Halloween, so it is it's dated by a couple months, but it is we had a lot of fun talking with Russ.
You have a lot of references to a Republican-controlled House of Representatives. So if it seems dated to you guys,
sorry.
It's because
it
was pre-midterm election.
Yeah, what are we going to do?
So I hope everyone has enjoyed our second Comics 101 episode. We're right now on the forum. We're looking for more suggestions for Comics 101.
I think we figured out what our next one is. But
yeah,
I think, preview. I think Tom may be doing a...
I'm going to do a Justice Society of America one.
Yeah. So, I'm excited about that. I want to know more about the Justice.
I'm excited about it,
too. I'm sure you are.
I don't know anything about that.
No, shush.
I don't know anything about
They're both visibly excited.
Like, yeah.
Woo!
Of course, they are sitting next to each other.
All we right, hugged folks. During the entire podcast, Hillary. It's not just for you.
All right, we
excuse
have
me. I'm going to go read my copy of Psychoanalysis.
No, Hillary likes to
seduction
watch
of the
podcast.
Innocence.
Seduction of the podcast.
All right, a couple announcements here. Want to remind everyone to help us out by spreading the Around Comics love. You can take part of our listener LCS challenge. Details about that on the website. You can also give us a dig at dig.com. You can become our virtual friend at Comic Space, which is www.comicspace.com/aroundcomics. And my personal favorite, you can leave us a review at the iTunes Music Store. You can be as cool as Andy Parks, who I know is a big EC Comics fan.
Yeah. Sure. Well, who is
he?
Andy looks a little like the Crypt Keeper, doesn't he? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Andy lost his hair.
Yes.
I'm just kidding, Andy.
Oh, my
Andy.
God. Ready, leave it.
Quick, edit that out.
Oh, no.
There's also the Watchmen contest that's going on.
So yes, who watches the caters? Go to the website for details. And Tom is giving.
I've only gotten four entries so far, so you have a pretty good chance.
The first week.
No, I'm just saying I'm encouraging people to enter because you have a very good chance of winning.
It's a $100 book, isn't it, or $75?
$75.
It's
retail price.
It's pricey.
If you live in a foreign country, it's probably very hard to find.
And Tom will ship it to wherever you are.
I'll meet you halfway.
Oh, man.
Speaking of meeting us halfway, why don't you meet us halfway between here and the website? So why don't you check out all the great things that AroundComics.com has to offer?
Great segue,
is that like,
Tom.
Is that like 2 feet closer to your computer? Where is that exactly?
I'll tell you what. It's
at rest stop 489 on the information highway.
Meet me in Northwest Indiana for porn and cheap cigarettes. It's your source of the best in comic book news, reviews, and opinions. While you're there, please take a minute to fill out our listener survey. It lets us know who we're talking to and how we can make Around Comics a better show, if that was possible. High five, everyone.
We are proud members of the Comics Podcast Network. The CPN is a collection of some of the best comics podcasts on the net. You can learn more about the network and find out more great podcasts at comicspodcast.com.
I did want to mention I will be posting all the research stuff that we just read on the website with some additional information if you're interested in going over it all again without my stumbling.
Yeah, you can read it slower.
Sorry, I was.
Check out.
I was trying to keep up
with him. I couldn't even read as fast as he can talk. I'm telling you.
Hillary's like, he's reading really fast. I was like, that's a good thing, Hillary.
It's good.
Just so everyone.
So fast.
Oh, one more thing about the website I wanted to mention is that
rules.
If
you know, that really assume... wasn't fair to all our slower listeners. Really, I don't know. You guys really ought to think about these people.
Our slower listeners are still on episode 42.
So they can take the LP and play it at a slower speed. I wanted to say, you know, I'm always trying to make advances. Yeah, I'm always trying to make the website better, but. Don't assume that I know that there's a problem. That if you're experiencing a problem with the website, feel free to send me an email at sal@aroundcomics.com.
Yeah, if you hate it, tell Sal.
Well, no, I don't want
to. I have a problem with the content.
Shut up.
Is that a mistake?
No, that's not what I'm talking about.
Is it your content,
Purely
Tom?
Purely technical errors. I know I've had at least a couple of people tell me they were having a problem with it with their browsers, but at this point I haven't been able to figure it out. But
that picture of me is not big enough, by the way.
Sorry, that splash. That splash is on there. He does kind of resemble you in some ways, but there you go.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Dallas Hillary in ink, and he's splashed. I see it.
Yeah.
Just
Hillary
so
Hillary leaves a stain everywhere he goes.
but
that's not ink.
Those damn sloppy Joes. Just so everyone is aware, we post the next week's topic on Tuesdays at our forum at aroundcomics.com.
Yes. I would like to thank everyone for joining us today. Sal, Tom, as always. Mr. Barda, it is always a pleasure to have you drop by.
Yeah, you're just saying that. Thanks.
No. We don't know shit about EC Comics.
Actually, that history was informative even to me. And obviously I was there.
I would like to put a disclaimer on it. It could be completely false, but I tried to do as much...
Best information that the internet could provide.
So Max Gaines saved a young boy from
drama? Rumor. Some people state that is what... But, you know, who knows? I don't know. I don't know for sure.
Later his son corrupted the minds of small children.
Of 10 million children.
10 million.
Ten million
juvenile delinquents.
Yes, came out everywhere.
With that hit comic called "Swimming Just After You Ate" magazine, gloriously depicting swimming immediately after a hearty dinner.
I've got a mint collection of stomach cramp monthly. Right.
Jesus.
All right, folks. Well, if you are interested at all in EC Comics, which we certainly hope that you are, check back for our interview with Russ Cochran. We had a lot of fun with him. After that, have a fantastic weekend. We'll be back again next Monday with another new episode. In the meantime, we'll be everywhere in
and around comics.
Glorious divorce.
Would like to suggest a topic, send us your comments, or are interested in becoming a panel member, email us at info@aroundcomics.com or visit the Contact Us section of our website. Music for the show provided by the Podshow Podsafe Music Network, music.podshow.com. Views expressed in the interviews or by guests of the show are solely those of the individuals expressing them and do not reflect the opinions of Around Comics. Thank you for listening today, and remember to join us next time when the panel will change, but our mission will stay the same. Bringing you the very best news, reviews, and opinions in and around comics. Around Comics is a Pipe Dream production. Copyright 2006. All rights reserved. Love you, baby. Yeah. Why you got my love and left me alone? Why you got my love alone? I know that you don't love me. Baby, love you one more time.